Morning, everyone. We will call the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee meeting to order. Representative Albright, we have a motion on the minutes.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes of April 6th.
Representative Albright moves the minutes from April 6th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. That, members, obviously we have a very aggressive agenda. We will be coming back this evening. We won't get through everything, or we try to get through everything this morning. We have a couple bills, actually, that we won't actually take possession of until after the floor session as well, that are on the agenda. But we can hopefully get through as many as possible this morning. With that, welcome to the committee, Representative Johnson. House File 3423. Go ahead and move House File 3423 for you and refer it to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3423 is actually a bill that streamlines and reduces the size of government. It combines the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force and the Advisory Group into one group. Minnesota Statute 299C.65 gives authority to both groups for guidance, integration, and priorities of the criminal justice data in Minnesota, and they have completed that responsibility with the original goals and adopted the strategic plans to shift the focus to a single advisory group providing input on statewide criminal justice information policy and funding issues. The Criminal and Juvenile Justice Policy Group and the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Task Force voted affirmatively in 2015 to create this advisory group. The role of the group would be to provide recommendations about criminal data practices issues, information sharing, innovation, and impact of legislation on the criminal justice information system and businesses' processes to the governor, judicial branch, and the legislature. The proposed legislation creates the resulting criminal and juvenile justice information advisory group and outlines the ongoing roles and their responsibility. And to speak on that, I have Andrew Evans from BCA.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Drew Evans, and I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Representative Johnson noted, this group has been meeting since the early 90s, working on criminal justice information initiatives to advise policymakers like yourself. As part of a strategic planning process in 2015, they determined that they've met many of those statutory goals, and these were two groups meeting separately four times a year, quarterly, and they determined that while there's still a lot of information sharing issues that need to be examined by this group, it could be better served to combine these two groups, continuing to represent all of the interests involved. There was overwhelming support from both of these groups to merge into one group, and they will continue to meet. They will continue to meet under this new language examine issues such as data practices, information sharing at the local and state and federal levels, technology and education and innovation, and then discuss the impact of any proposed legislation on the criminal justice system to advise policymakers like yourself, and then data and identification standards. This group would continue to report to the legislative bodies, the governor's office, and the Supreme Court in the state of Minnesota, and as I noted, they will continue to represent the same interests. Rather, it would reduce the size of these two groups into one and reduce redundant meetings. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions for members.
Thank you, Mr. Evans, for your testimony. Members, any questions or discussion? Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. One quick question. I just noticed on 6.23 that, so it's an advisory group including any funds and grant requests, so it's not, doesn't hold any funds that they're distributed in themselves.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, that is correct. There are no funds that are currently appropriated to this group. The group thought that it should include some language in the event that funds were allocated to this, but currently receives no appropriations.
Thank you. Representative Johnson and Mr. Evans, any comment on the size of this advisory group? it seems like we're approaching like maybe 40 different members sitting here. Maybe just talk briefly as to why we need that many folks on an advisory board, and can we get anything accomplished if we have that many people?
Mr. Chair, members, the number would reduce by six, the current number, so 34 members would continue to remain on this group. As with any groups or task forces, there's a number of interests involved in this. This is how it's been operating previously with 40 members. Reduction by six, but it continues under this structure to represent the various interests involved. And there was a lot of discussion about the current makeup, the membership, how many should be, and this group voted on this current membership structure and feel that they can still be effective with the number of members that would be represented under this new group.
Thank you. Any member questions or discussion? Representative Rumbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment, if you would, the frequency of meetings, who chairs it. This is a well-established group and following the same procedures they had in the, under the previous descriptions.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the current structure is that they're chaired differently under the current structure of the statute. The policy group is chaired by the Department of Public Safety Commissioner. Under this new structure, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension has always provided administrative support to these two groups. The new statute would allow that we would call and convene the first meeting, and then the group would elect a chair under this statute. So they would elect a chair and vice chair under the new statutory language, and so it would be different than the current language.
Well, Mr. Chair, the meetings are at the call of the chair, or is it a regularly scheduled meeting?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm sorry, they would meet quarterly. They would continue to meet quarterly under this, and so that is how the frequency that they would meet.
All right. Thank you.
Seeing no further member discussion, Representative Johnson will give you the final word.
Mr. Chair, members, being appointed to this group, but I see how important it is to what they do. It's a very diverse group with a lot. Everybody that has involvement in this, from the county level, the city level, all the way up to the state level. And I think by streamlining this, it'll stop some of the redundancy and actually be able to do their work better.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, I'll renew my motion that House File 3423 be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Johnson. Next on the agenda, Representative Hamilton.
Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chair.
We have two bills up today, I believe. Which one would you like to
take? Yes, you do. We'll start with House File 2345.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I will go ahead and move House File 2345 in Committee on HHS Finance.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This bill has come a long way. The stakeholders have met in the interim. We've made a lot of accommodations to all the stakeholders, if you will. I don't believe we have anybody opposing this bill at this time, and I do have a testifier here, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'll answer any questions that you may have or walk you through the bill. This is an interpreter's bill, so I'll turn it over to the testifier.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Kathleen Urbane, and I'm with the Interpreting Stakeholder Group. And I believe your purview is the advisory council in this bill.
That's right.
And so that's all I will speak to. And it's a 12-person advisory board. 50% are from the limited English proficiency community and 50% from the stakeholders. So three individuals are interpreters, and three individuals are members of the limited English proficiency community directly, so they could be any range of people. And then the other six are medical providers, insurance plans, interpreting agencies, organizations that provide training for interpreters, things like that. And the duties basically fall into two categories. One is to keep the four tiers for competency and training up to date with national standards and to advise the commissioner on any issues that might be appearing nationally. And then the other very important is to look at any impediments that there might be to interpreters accessing the registry, and to identify those issues, whether they're issues in the rural areas or issues in for low-frequency languages, and try to identify methods for addressing them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, any questions or discussion to the bill in front of us? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this is to the testifier or to Representative Hamilton. In fact, I don't know if either one of them know the answer to this question. It's more of a process question. Someone that is in need of an interpreter for the purposes laid out here, are they entitled to that interpreter indefinitely once they come to this country, or is there a way of saying, you know, after so many years, we feel like you should know the language, so... do the taxpayers pay for the interpreters, and how does that all work?
There is no language in statute, either state or federal, that puts a time limit on that. It's a dialogue between the medical provider and the person with limited English proficiency. And as you might imagine, I think the issue is often in the opposite direction, because people who are often very proud of their ability to speak English, and sometimes their ability to speak English doesn't match the needs in a medical encounter with the requirements. And so they will say, we don't want an interpreter. And the issue that providers often face is, we think that you need an interpreter because we're required to provide accurate information. And so there's developed what's called a shadow interpreter, so that if the family indeed wants to speak directly without an interpreter, and as a provider you're concerned, you can have a professional interpreter there who will just listen and correct for any miscommunications.
Thank you.
Any other member questions or discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Chair Hamilton, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and community members. I ask for your support.
Thank you. Members, with that, I'll renew my motion that House File 2345 be referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can stay right there, Chair Hamilton, and we will move House File 3363.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. This actually was first brought to my attention by the Executive Director for the Center for Rural Policy and Development, former Representative Brad Finstead. And we're talking about how there's been a tremendous amount of rural grocery stores that have been closing, and to what could we be doing to think differently. And then a number of people approached me after that as well with similar interests. And I know you have a very busy agenda here, Mr. Chairman, so if I could just turn over to the testifier that could walk us through the bill here quick and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just for the record, the motion will be to send us to Ag Finance.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callanan. I'm Regional Vice President of Advocacy for the American Heart Association, and we are very much in support of the Good Food Access Fund being established. I want to give just a quick overview about the bill just so you have a little context. You should be getting two handouts, one which was referenced by Representative Hamilton from the Center for Rural Policy Development, and the other is our handout for the Good Food Access Fund. And I don't want to go into too much detail because I know the jurisdiction of this committee is focused more on the working group that we plan to establish under the legislation, but I did just want to give you a glimpse into what the problem that we are trying to solve with the legislation. Currently, hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans, about 340,000 Minnesotans, do live in low access areas of the state where they do not have healthy, nutritious food available to them. And they are often low-income people with limited mobility, seniors, people that may not be able to drive or don't have a car, have some limited access to transportation. So this is a growing problem in the state of Minnesota. The Center for Rural Policy Development did find that overall in greater Minnesota, between 2000 and 2013, there's been a 14% reduction in grocery stores, and that's just in greater Minnesota. So we know that it's a growing problem, and that's why we came to Representative Hamilton and appreciate his leadership in introducing this bill to establish the Good Food Access Program. The program would have $10 million per year going to grocery stores, convenience stores, other food retailers to help them with loans, grants, or technical assistance so that they can stay viable in the community. Sometimes, for example, a convenience store may need to expand their refrigeration so that they can have healthier foods available to their customers. So there are a range of models that the legislation could help to fund, and so that's our goal. But the focus of this committee is primarily the program advisory group that would be established to help advise the Department of Agriculture in the establishment of criteria and guidelines for the program. So the Department of Agriculture has much experience in providing loans and grants throughout the state for a variety of different programs. This is a little newer of an area for them, getting into healthy food retail or nutritious food. And so we felt that it was important to for them to create a program advisory group that could really help them understand the dynamics both in the marketplace but also in how to put together the right financing for these kinds of projects, as well as some of the food handling issues. So they're, you know, people who have not been maybe selling fresh produce may have a challenge with how to keep that produce fresh over a period of time so it can be sold to their customers. So that is our goal with this program advisory group, and my understanding is the Department of Ag is very interested in convening these stakeholders to get their input and feedback about how this program should move forward. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions. First of all, is this a secret attempt by Gunther to reestablish his chain of groceries all over southern Minnesota?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Second, a real question. I couldn't get through it this quick. We have food deserts in the inner city.
That's right.
Is that being taken care of here also?
Chair Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. We're addressing that as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we do have two amendments.
Yes, sir.
If you'd like to take them up at this time.
Are those author's amendments, or do we have members that are claiming those amendments?
They're author's amendments, but
author's
if someone
amendments.
Would like to claim them, that's fine, too.
That's fine. Excellent. Then I will move the A4 amendment as an author's amendment. Any discussion before we put the bill in the shape the author wishes on the A4?
And, Mr. Chairman, this is simply adding the Minnesota Grocers Association to that board as well.
Excellent. All in favor of the A4, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The A4 is adopted. And the A5 is also an author's amendment.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And this would add Second Harvest Heartland to the board. And I ask for your support.
Move the A5. Members, any discussion to put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the A5, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Chair Hamilton, back to your bill as amended.
Mr. Chairman, we'll stand for questions.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Hamilton, I'm looking on page 4 with regard to ostensibly why this bill is in front of the committee, and I'm wondering if you could just elaborate on the advisory group or the program advisory group from the perspective of rulemaking authority, the responsiveness to the Ag Commissioner. And I see on 4.28 and 4.29 that there's a mandate for monitoring and accountability mechanisms, and I'm just wondering what those would be.
Chair Hamilton?
The testifier will take that question, please.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, in answer to your first question, the program advisory group is, in this legislation, just that. So ultimately, the buck does stop with the Department of Agriculture and the Commissioner of Agriculture to determine the parameters of the program. The idea was to have this program advisory group give advice and expertise that the commissioner may not already have access to. So that was our coalition's concern, was to make sure that the program move forward with the best expertise so that it can be as successful as possible. To answer your second question, the monitoring and accountability, I believe there is, towards the very end of the section, a legislative report that's due. So on page 7, starting at line 7.3, there's a legislative report that outline some of the parameters that would be included in that legislative report.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No further questions.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the handout that you sent us. On the back of that are your footnoted references, and numbers 2 and 3, are those longitudinal studies references, or are those like articles that were written on this subject matter?
Either, yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I'm just having to look back because I don't have the whole fact sheet memorized. So that first, under footnote 2, there was a study that was conducted by the Food Trust, which is a national organization that works on these food access issues and healthy food financing initiatives all around the country. And they had a grant to work with Minnesota to actually do a study, and so that is the result of that work. So I believe that they were using existing data sources. I don't believe that they were doing any primary data gathering themselves, but were relying on American Community Survey or census data to put that information together. The second report, honestly, I am not super familiar with. I would have to go and look at it more closely.
Follow up, Representative Scott.
Well, the front page, you know, makes the statement that the limited access to healthy and affordable foods results in disproportionately higher rates of obesity, diabetes, and other diet-related problems. And I just wanted to see the longitudinal study that backed up that statement, because there are other factors certainly that can contribute to those three things. And I wanted to see the data that said it was the disproportionate factor, and I don't, you know, that's why I asked the question. That's all.
To the testifier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I'd be happy to follow up with you with more data on that front.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on Representative Scott's question, I have been serving on the legislative workforce on childhood obesity, and these statements are very much in line with the research that we have seen in our work group, particularly when talking about causes and problems with obesity and nutrition. And indeed, one of the very interesting things we learned in that committee is a person can be obese and malnourished at the same time. And because we have found a way to make calories extremely cheap, and so this is why focusing on healthy food and good food is so important for long-term health, because we know that obesity leads to long-term chronic health problems, which are extremely expensive. So the research is out there, and it's extensive, so I'm sure Representative Scott will probably get a lot of it now. So,
thank you, Representative Halverson. Any other member questions or discussion? Seeing none, Chair Hamilton will give you the final word.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I simply ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hamilton. With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 3363 We refer to the Committee on Ag Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
As amended, yes. Representative Hackbarth. Welcome back to the committee, Chair Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I will move House File 3685 to be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're here to speak about the rules on this dry cleaner issue. And with me today, I have Ms. Sherry Munyon, and she will explain where we're at on the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Munyon.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Sherry Munyon, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Cleaners Association. The bill before you completes requirements in last year's omnibus finance bill. The amended bill clarifies the statutory definition of a dry cleaner and improves the viability of the fund, also releasing the appropriation made last year. Specifically to your committee's interest is the provision on rules. We are providing expedited rulemaking authority to the MPCA for the purposes of enhancing the dry cleaner fund, and we are invoking subdivision 5, which is a provision that has to be included in the statute, and it allows for the industry to push the expedited rulemaking into general rulemaking if they don't reach consensus on the rules. And by the way, they are working cooperatively, and we expect there will be consensus on the rules. The amendment also provides a provision that allows for the rulemaking as it pertains only to the rates in the future to be ongoing. The Minnesota Cleaners Association board member Dart Poach is in the audience, and also Deputy Commissioner Kurt Kudelka from the PCA are in the audience. They both support the bill. In the interest of time, they won't testify, but answer questions if you have them.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And then I understand that it's written here, where Chair Hackbarth, it's your intent that the expedited rulemaking only be to adjust the reimbursement amounts.
That's correct.
Members, any questions or discussion to the House file in front of us? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that needs to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Chair Hackbarth will give you the final word.
We're good, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for your time. We're respectful of your time.
Thank you for that. With that, members, I'll renew my motion. The House file 3685. Be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thank Chairman, you. Members. Thank you.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's see, we have House File 2810. I will make a motion that House File 2810 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thanks for taking the time to hear the bill. This bill is to streamline the process for police and firefighter families to receive benefits when they die in the line of duty. The current process in the state of Minnesota requires grieving families to meet up to 3 different standards in killed in the line of duty: PRA, DPS, and the federal standard. This has caused not only confusion, but significant delays in receiving benefits, sometimes for over 5 years. The bill does the following. It provides the family to be able to apply just to the Commissioner of Public Safety. If the Commissioner determines that the death is in line of duty, then PRA pays the appropriate benefits. It provides for federal conformity with the federal current Hometown Heroes Act. It provides the line of duty death benefits for those that die within 24 hours of responding to an incident, and then they die of either a heart attack, stroke, or vascular rupture. And 3, it eliminates the catch-22 that some families find themselves in when they qualify for federal benefits and their definition of killed in the line of duty, but yet the state denies them due to different standard because they need a local agency determination of line of duty death in order to receive the death benefits. I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Howe. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, briefly I will speak to this matter because as the Chair of the Pensions Commission this year, Representative Howell needed to bring this to the Commission. A little background, the Senate co-author on this is Senator Pappas, who's also the Vice Chair of Pensions. Pensions unanimously agreed to take this into the pensions bill, not this portion, but the portion that deals with pensions, last Tuesday evening. And this is the definition that will be used to determine that payout of the benefits from the pension side. So, members, I would strongly encourage a green vote or a yes on this today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Any other member questions or comments? Representative Howe, did you have any testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair, but I was only going to bring them down if there was questions, questions of the technical nature that I couldn't answer.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Howell, and maybe Representative O'Driscoll can answer. Is PARA on board with this, and they're okay? I mean, you said it went through the Pension Commission, so I'm assuming they are, but if we don't have to drag them down there, that'd be okay.
Representative Howell.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Nelson, everyone's on board. There's no opposition to the bill.
Members, any other questions or discussion to this House file? Seeing none, we'll give you the final word.
Just appreciate the time and thank you for your support.
Thank you, Representative Howe. With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 2810 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Howe. Representative Slocum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two bills in front of the committee today.
Sure, we'll take House File 2625 up first. I'll make a motion that House File 2625 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. With that, welcome to the committee.
Would it be possible to hear 3558 first since my testifier is right here?
We can do that. I guess we can lay House File 2625 over. And then.
Can you?
Okay. We'll take
never
up.
Mind. Mr. Chair, never mind. We're okay. We're okay.
You sure? All right. All right. We will bring House File 2625 back in front of the committee, and it is going to public safety. To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this and committee for hearing this bill. House File 2625 has to do with Richfield firefighters. They have a time response residency that's been in effect for a number of years. It expires, it's expired, April 2nd, 2010. They want to re-up the bill for response time residency, and what it does, what response time residency is within a certain parameter of response time for fire calls, a firefighter may live within that response time. So I have my fire chief here. I believe the response time is 10 minutes, isn't it?
That's correct.
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Wayne Kiewicz, Fire Chief, City of Richfield.
And all this bill does, it costs nothing. It saves Richfield money. Costs nothing to the state. It just re-ups the response time residency requirement to December 31st, 2026.
Thank you, Representative Slocum. Members, any questions or discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Chief, did you have any other comments to add to the bill?
None. It's been labor management working together. It's been a very, very big success for our fire department and the city and the citizens.
Excellent. Good to hear. Members, final opportunity for questions or discussion on this bill. Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 2625 be referred to the Committee on Public Safety. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, Representative Slocum will bring up House File 3558, and that is being referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. In 3558, the current law in Minnesota statutes permits cities and towns to provide funding for history work in their area. If you read the statute, literally, it says that city and township governments are not allowed to support historical efforts in their own city or township, but that they can only support county historical societies. This issue was brought to me by the Richfield Historical Society. We know of at least four areas where this is an issue, Richfield being one of them, Schroeder, and if you've never seen Schroeder's Historical Society, it's great. It's really fun. Richfield is great also, but up on the North Shore. Delwood has an issue with this, and so does Rogers, where the local unit of government is willing to help preserve the history of the area, but it's been advised it can't do it because it's not a county unit, historical society. This bill simply adds the words city, town, or to the statute, three words. And it's a very permissive bill because it just says may. So city, towns, or don't have to contribute to their historical society, but may contribute. This bill is supported by the Minnesota Historical Society and the Minnesota League of Cities. That's pretty much it. My testifier is Mr. David Butler, and he is the president of the Richfield Historical Society.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I think I was asked to testify just to put a face on this bill. The Richfield Historical Society was organized at the promotion of a group of women who wanted to save the Bartholomew House. It was built in 1852, one of the oldest structures in the state. And they were successful, and money was raised to restore that. Then the society built the Richfield History Center in a building adjoining the Bartholomew House, and they raised money for that. Then the society had a book published called The Richfield History, and they raised money for that. We were able to make a substantial profit off the sale of the book, and we've been using that along with community support for the operation of the center. We had a professional director, but we've run out of money now from the sale of the book, and so we're looking for other sources of revenue. So we went to the city council and asked for $10,000 a year for operating expenses. I think we're typical of other historical societies. A lot easier to raise money for capital improvements than it is for operating costs. So the city, at a study session, took up the matter of the request, and they were discussing it, and the city attorney stopped them and said, wait a minute, you don't have authority to do this. Said, you can give to your county historical society, but you can't give money to your own municipal county historical society. So that ended that. So that prompted us to suggest to the Minnesota Historical Society that they take this to the legislature and get that law amended. So that's why we're here. Urge your support to give the city of Richfield the authority to do what they want in supporting the historical society.
Thank you, Mr. Butler, for your testimony. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification for Mr. Shepard. Town in this reference refers to township. I've asked that question. Ms. Dyson, I'm sorry. My recollection is I've asked this question in the past, but I'm not exactly sure which part of statute this is referring to, just to make sure we don't have an issue with the definition of town meaning township.
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, town is the proper term for an organized town. The statutes over the years were messy, using town and township interchangeably, and in the recent years there's been an effort to clean up the statute so town refers to organized town, and township goes back to the congressional townships, which are different have a different definition. So,
Representative O'Driscoll.
A question to the bill author then. Representative Slocum, is that what you're looking for? I mean, do you know the difference between that? I mean, so I've raised this question because we do have some.
I have hearing aids, so I don't quite hear that.
The question, sir, was, is the bill author getting the intended result that she wants by having the word town and how it's defined in statute, and is, or is she thinking of a different use of the word township?
I suppose the Minnesota Historical Society could better address that. My interest is in the cities.
Representative Slocum.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, we are getting the benefit that we would like to get, would like to see. And again, it's very permissive. The other thing that I want to stress that I didn't before was that no city or town may appropriate any funds for the benefit of any historical society unless the society is affiliated with and approved by the Minnesota Historical Association. So someone can't throw a shingle and say, hey, we're the Historical Society, unless they've got Minnesota Historical Society permission.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe to the bill author. I think I talked to, I sent in a note to Mr. Shepherd, too. Maybe you can clarify. When it comes to city, should it say home rule, charter, or statutory, just in case, so we don't have people coming back with clarifications next session?
Ms. Dyson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin, in statutes, when it's permissive, unless a town, a home rule charter city's charter prohibits it, there's a savings clause in 410.33 that says a home rule charter city can exercise the powers of a statutory city as long as the charter doesn't prohibit it. And so I think it's fine.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Chair. Just wanted to say future work for this committee, so thank you.
Good point. Members, any other question or discussion? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Butler, for your testimony. Representative Slocum, do you have any closing comments?
It's a good bill. Please vote for it.
Excellent. With that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 3558 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, before you step away, I thought you said the original motion was to send it to General Register, and then you said that when we voted on it was State Gov Finance. Was that correct? I'm just
Representative Nelson, the motion to State Government Finance is correct.
Okay, I just thought I heard when the first time you said General Register, and that's how I wrote it down. So
the last bill was sent.
Okay, my apologies if I did, but the motion is to State Government Finance. Thank you.
This one's going to the floor.
Okay. So as Chair Sanders moves nimbly to the testifiers table, we are going to be taking up House File 2688. Chair Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll bring House File 2688 back in front of the committee, and we are in the middle of discussion on the A1 amendment.
Yes, that is the Nelson A1 amendment. Representative Nelson.
I'd like to pull my request for a roll call on that amendment.
Okay, Representative Nelson removes his request for a roll call. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion, it is not adopted. So, Chair Sanders, to the bill.
Thank you, Representative Nash, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. We adopted the DE1 last committee, and this is the elections, what will be the elections omnibus bill. I think we have a very strong, non-controversial, bipartisan bill here, and look forward to discussing with the Senate and taking this bill to conference committee and hopefully returning again with a good, strong, bipartisan, non-controversial elections bill. With that, members, I'd stand for any questions and look forward to your support.
Members, questions? That many? Okay, Chair Sanders, to your bill. Renew your motion to send this to the General Register, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll renew my motion that House File 2688 be referred to the General Register as amended.
Okay, members, House File 2688 to the General Register, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Very good. As amended.
Now we can nimbly go back.
Mary's back there. We'll bring up Mary first. Welcome to the committee. Representative Murphy will do House File 2371.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 2371 is update on the joint subcommittee of claims technical amendments. Ms. Timmons is the counsel for the joint claims committee and can go into the delete everything amendment in detail if you so wish.
Okay, thank you, Representative Murphy. The motion on this bill, House File 2371, is to refer to the Civil Law Committee. With that, members, we will take the A16, is that correct, Representative Murphy, as an author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I will
Chair.
Move the A16 as an author's amendment. Any discussion before we put the bill to shape, the author wishes. Seeing none, all in favor of the A16, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Murphy, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I said, it's technical update to the way we've been doing the claims for a century. Ms. Timmons can explain in detail.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Timmons.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Michelle Timmons. I'm the reviser of statutes, but I'm before you today with my hat on as the legal counsel to the Joint House-Senate Subcommittee on Claims. And what this bill does, the delete everything, does a number of cleanup items for the claims procedures. For many, many years, the Subcommittee on Claims has been hearing property claims from inmates in correctional institutions, the ones that have been denied by the Department of Corrections, so that the process coming before the subcommittee is almost like an appeal or a second shot at their property claims. And that's been the process for a very long time. A few years ago, we also started to hear some Department of Human Services claims. And what happened is the young attorney for the Department of Human Services testified, well, the subcommittee has no jurisdiction to hear these property claims because the tort liability statute excludes from tort liability all of the any property claims for patients or inmates of state institutions. Well, you can imagine how well that went over at a legislative hearing that someone was saying, you don't have jurisdiction over this. So the subcommittee members have been hearing DHS property claims as well under the same auspices as the long-term corrections property claims. So what Section 1 of the bill would do, of the delete everything, is it leaves in the exclusion for these claims in the tort liability statute, but it adds an exception for a new section of statute that deals with the property claims in front of the subcommittee. So what this will do is allow the courts to still dismiss these claims, saying there is no liability. And then if the only way to deal with this property claim is to go in front of the Legislative Subcommittee on Claims, the new section 3.381 would say this is the exclusive remedy. And it's only to hear claims that have been denied at the agency level, or if they're over $7,000. Why $7,000 and the $7,000 amount is also in Section 3. Mm-hmm. The reason is there is a general statute, 3.732, that basically says any state agency can settle any case, death, injury, property, any claim based on negligence of state employees for up to $7,000. And so this, both Section 2 and Section 3, by updating the dollar amounts to the general dollar amount that every agency has, it just harmonizes all the provisions. With respect to Section 3, it does something in addition. Section 3, it's hard to tell because with the amendable unit, you just see subdivision 2. But this is the provision of law that allows the subcommittee to deal with sentenced to servants, clients who are out in the community, in the counties, and doing work for the counties. And if they get hurt, instead of having the DOC pay for their medical claims or the cost of medical treatment, the community resources are providing treatment. And what is happening is that with a $500 limit, providers out in the communities are waiting for a year or more to get reimbursed for that medical treatment. So this raising this limit will really allow those medical providers to be paid more expeditiously. And they're paid at the medical assistance rate, but still $500 is a pretty small amount. And then finally, Section 4, the delete everything, raises the amount of the filing, the claim filing fee from $5 to $8.
Thank you, Ms. Timmons, for your testimony. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Timmons, on Section 4 there, when was the last time that filing fee was increased?
Ms. Timmons?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I don't recall. I know it's been $5 the entire 18 years that I've been reviser, so I don't know the last time, but it was a long time ago.
Okay.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, one of the recommendations to raise it at this time was because the amount of money per hour that a worker gets or a client gets has been raised. Mm-hmm. And so the recommendation was for $10, from $5 to $10, but I thought that $8 was on better equity for the raises that they were getting. But you also have to know that if the claim is good, they get their fee back.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I wasn't really objecting. I was thinking that maybe for the labor involved in preparing the claim and administering it, that it might, you know, might be worth more even. So, thank you.
Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck. I think there's trying to be a balance here between having it high enough to weed out frivolous claims from inmates, particularly on these property claims, but on the other hand, recognizing that the wages they get in the prison are not at the same level as wages in the community. So the bills introduced had 10. Representative Murphy was more comfortable with 8. it's a balancing act.
Well, Representative Runback.
Mr. Chair, the claims that you handle, they're not all for residents of state institutions, are they? Some are from the private and the public sector? I mean, the public to private sector?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Runback, that's absolutely correct. We get all kinds of claims against all various agencies. We have one against the DNR for somebody's damage to somebody's sod farm or loss mm-hmm. of income at a sod farm due to a ditch. We've had one for remnants of a bridge being deposited in people's backyards. Occasionally, there are claims that deal with hardship for filing your claim for a property tax refund. We get claims that are all over the board and all agencies.
So then, Mr. Chair, I could...
Representative Runback.
So then those, and I can understand you're trying to sort of have this one be, you know, in relation to the incomes earned, but for the private sector then, is there a different filing fee?
Ms. Timmons, that's another question that can be answered in state government finance as well. But Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Runback, no. The filing fee is the same for all claimants.
Thank you.
Any other member questions? Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, remind me again how long you've been co-chair of the Claims Committee.
Oh. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, it escapes my memory.
Mr. Chair, I'm just
chuckling
because when I worked for Senator Latz, I had to sit through many of those claims committee, and they are very interesting and eye-opening. And if people don't understand what Ms. Timmons said at the beginning, it's these are for people that don't have any court opportunity through the tort system because they're residents of one of our fine state facilities, or they feel like the courts have done them wrong and this is the case of the last appeal. And I'm trying to remember those times. What percentage would you say really is DOC or maybe even DHS claims? It always felt like that was the heavier load of the agenda, like 75%,
80%
was from
the public. Mr. Chair, I think it's... over 90.
Yeah.
And DOT gets a few once in a while, too, but mostly it's those. But we did chickens once for the Department of Ag.
Thank you, Mr.
Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Sanders. I just wanted to clarify that the majority of the claims are from DOC and DHS.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like Representative Joachim is trying to replace Representative Murphy and take your spot.
8 years, wasn't it?
Mary, are you looking to testify on this bill? Just answer questions or there for support?
Support.
All right. Excellent. Any final member questions or discussion? Final comments, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I heard your message at the beginning to send it to civil law. Does civil law really want it?
Well, the good news is we have the civil law chair right here with us today. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. It does have to do with civil claims, so it should technically come to our committee.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, the Claims Commission, the Joint Committee is meeting on Tuesday night for its first and only committee meeting of this year. And so I guess this bill is going to travel separately and be on the floor separately then, too. And we won't be able to incorporate it into the civil claims bill.
Well, I will say,
I mean into the joint claims bill.
Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, I know that we've been experiencing this session on the floor a lot of questions about whether bills should have or should not have been referred. Unfortunately, timing is an issue on this, but the civil law chair did say that it does have civil issues in there, and it should. Unfortunately, it may not make the bill, but we have had a high instance of people asking for bills to be re-referred because they felt that they hadn't. So I would want to make sure that we don't take time on the House floor to have to re-refer a bill and that we attempt to do committee work in the committee process. Just advice, Mr. Chair.
I would say, Representative Murphy, I'm not exactly sure how the Claims Committee builds their legislation or what their process is necessarily. You know, I mean, we certainly have ways in our committee process to add language in where we need to, when we need to. So maybe there are ways to get that done. Welcome to the committee.
Chairman, my name is Lisa Netzer. I'm Associate General Counsel with the DOC, and I oversee the claims process within the DOC. I actually can speak to this a little bit in that I'm often the attorney arguing that claims have nothing to do with civil process. According to the statute and according to this amendment, actually, we are trying to remove claims from the civil process and saying they have no place in court. They simply have a place before the legislative subcommittee. So it does reflect on civil process, but really it's an attempt to completely remove claims from that civil process, and therefore there is an open question as to whether it should really go before another committee. I just want to make that clear that that's part of the purpose of this amendments.
Thank you, Ms. Netzer. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could have Mr. Gehring weigh in on this, I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Gehring, could you help us with the process here, please?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, so this bill does contain some policy changes that amend the State Tort Claims Act, and historically, as in my other hat, I also staff the Civil Law Committee, and these types of bills typically do go to the Civil Law Committee, but it's always up to the chair of that committee to make that determination. So, even if the intent of the bill is to take this policy out of the civil process, the fact that there's an amendment to the Tort Claims Act would historically be a civil law issue.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. So, Representative Murphy, what we'll do is we'll send this to civil law. There are obviously many different ways for us to help, and I think one of the things that we can do is figure out how this language can end up in the Claims Committee or not. I mean, that's a sidebar discussion, but it does need to go to civil law. I mean, we have the rules process here as well that can help move things through the legislative process as well. So hopefully we can find a way to accommodate the Claims Committee legislation or report that will come out. So
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and thank you also for your understanding and patience.
Yes. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Murphy. And with that, members, I'll renew my motion that House File 2371 be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Pugh, House File 3551. And Representative Pugh, you are welcome to make a motion on your bill. I believe it should be going to the Jobs Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And yes, I would like to move that House File 3551 be moved to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability.
To your bill.
Current Minnesota law allows the state of Minnesota and the University of Minnesota to use something called job order contracting and other more modern methods of procurement and project delivery than traditional design bid build contracting. Hennepin County seeks legislation to mirror that authority for its own procurement and project delivery for small construction, maintenance, and repair projects. The intent of this legislation is to improve efficiency, streamline processes, and most importantly, to engage more small and locally owned businesses to do work on Hennepin County buildings. Right now, when small jobs come up, such as rewiring a building, fixing broken pipes, remodeling offices, or repainting a building, the county is required to issue an invitation for bids or an RFP for those jobs. The fact is, many smaller companies simply don't have the resources to search for and respond to these solicitations. Under this bill, the process by which the county hires contractors will be streamlined. By having a list of qualified vendors, the county can turn to for construction projects under $250,000. As the bill sits now, the qualified contractor list will have to be reviewed at least every 3 years. And if there are more companies interested in getting on the list than there are openings, a public lottery will be held to fill out the list of vendors. These safeguards help ensure there's no political favoritism in the selection process and that new and different companies are given the chance to bid for public projects. Members, there's some more work to do on this bill, and specifically in this area of the previous statement that I just made. And I want for everyone to know that that work is going to begin this afternoon, and I look forward to getting that work done before this bill moves on to jobs. The changes to the statute to allow job order contracting for small construction projects would give Hennepin County the flexibility it needs to modernize its methods for procuring and delivering construction projects. Employing these well-established programs will give the county greater opportunities to save money, deliver projects more quickly, and enhance the inclusion of small business enterprises as prime and subcontractors. I know I have several testifiers here today. I've asked for them to be brief in the interest of the committee's time or lack thereof. So we'll start with my first testifier, please.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, I'm Chris Grand, Purchasing Manager, Hennepin County. And we look forward to having this purchasing authority so that we can engage more smaller businesses in our facility maintenance and repair projects. Currently, we have a lot of certified SBEs that are general contractors, mechanical, small businesses, electrical, plumbing. This authority will give us the ability to set up benches for each of those trades within regions of our facilities, Hennepin County facilities. We have about 6.5 million square feet of county facility that we maintain and repair. And this authority will allow us to get competitive bids from those firms on those benches. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How can we be assured that this won't affect negatively the amount of work TGBs get?
Mr. Grant?
Mr. Chair, targeted group businesses are, that's the state certification okay. program. And
you have a little different.
Representative Mullery.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I know that you go by small business or something, but how are we going to be sure that minority-owned businesses aren't getting their fair share?
Mr. Chair,
getting their fair share.
Right. The Targeted Group Business Program is, a lot of our certified small businesses are targeted group businesses. And Hennepin County is a race and gender neutral program. So we set goals for certain projects to meet, to involve certified SBEs in our projects. We don't set goals for minority business and women business enterprises.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I too have thought about that and have some questions and concerns about that, and would be delighted to work with you as we're working together. There's quite a collaboration of us as before we move to jobs. So I would be happy to do that.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to work with. I don't want to see even more minority businesses excluded, so.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Pugh, your next testifier.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Adam Hansen. I'm with the Associated Builders and Contractors. We represent over 350 contractors throughout the state that employ over 22,000 high-quality, multi-skilled craft professionals. We appreciate Representative Pugh's work on this bill. However, we do have a few concerns that we look forward to working with the county, Representative Pugh and others on this bill. Some of the concerns we have are about the limiting effect of this bill in terms of the number of contractors that can work on this. There's a pre-screened list in the bill, and then a number of those contractors that make the list will be used on the projects that the county is working on. And so we're going to hopefully work, and we're optimistic about working with her and the county about some of these concerns, as well as the three-year wait period, or at least three-year wait period for the cycling of new contractors that can maybe make the list. So those are some of our concerns. They'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Representative Pugh, did you have any other testifiers?
I don't believe I do, Mr. Chair.
So is there anyone else in the audience that feels the need to testify on this bill in front of us? Seeing none, member question and discussion. Is there any member questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, sir, forgot your name, but is there a rationale for the three-year wait period, Representative?
Mr. Chair and Representative Runback, that was the proposal, but that section right there is that I referenced is one of the areas that we're looking to tweak in a major way. It's just where we started, and there are a number of ideas that have already come forth that we're looking to embrace, and that will likely not be there going forward.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kirk Peterson, Rice, Michaels, and Rolfe, representing Hennepin County. Just a quick point of clarification on that, Representative Runbeck. It's not a three-year wait period. The list would have to be repopulated at least every 3 years to get more people involved in a chance to bid. And one of the discussions that we're having with ABC is making that probably an annual bid, so at least every 3 years, probably once a year, the county would have to put out a new request for qualifications to let contractors get in on the process. So it wouldn't be 3 years, it would be at least every 3 years and probably at least once a year, just to clarify that.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any other member questions, comments, discussion? Seeing none. Representative Pugh will renew her motion that House File 3551 be referred to the Committee on Job Growth and Energy Affordability. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, we're going to hit the pause button and go into a recess. We will come back into the basement shortly after session. With that, we are in recess. Good evening, everyone. We're going to come back from recess, call the Government Operations Committee meeting to order. Representative Chair Hoppe, welcome to Government Operations. I'll go ahead and move House File 3211 to the Committee on Ways and Means. And just so members know, we're waiting on the correct engrossment to be printed off, but we'll go ahead and let Chair Hoppe and his testifier go ahead and kind of walk through the bill. And as soon as we get the correct engrossment, we'll make sure all members have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for letting us be here this night. Tonight we'll try to be brief. We have two amendments to the bill that reflect changes that have happened between Mr. DePest and I'm not sure if somebody was talking about expedited rulemaking, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if that was you or Mr. Shepherd, but in any event, one of the shorter of the amendments deals with the expedited rulemaking process. And in the Chair's wisdom, I think that that's probably a good idea. Mr. DePasquale is not here. He's on his a flight out of town, but he has spoken to Ms. Tinsley and does not have a problem with that. The second amendment reflects and I'm kind of rambling here while we're waiting, but the second amendment reflects, I think, progress in the agreement, maybe not 100% the final agreement, but certainly a lot of progress in the agreement between the Racing Commission and our Minnesota Racetracks and Churchill Downs. And I have testified here, Mr. Scouta from the Racing Commission, that will explain that agreement in more detail.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Joe Skurdo, Deputy Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. I want to thank you for your time today. My understanding is that this bill was referred to GovOps Committee because of the provision in Section 12, Subdivision 9, Line 8.3, allowing for the MRC to adopt rules to implement its licensing and regulatory oversight of ADW providers in Minnesota. ADW providers, just briefly, are companies that are set up that maintain balances or monies in which horse players can wager in and out of. So winnings are credited to their accounts and losses are debited to their accounts. And the ADW providers provide this mechanism for maintaining those funds. You have a summary of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions relating to the bill, but in the interest of time, I'll describe why the exempt rulemaking procedure is appropriate in this situation. And as a background, this provision was suggested to us by Senate counsel and adopted in both chambers by an A1 amendment earlier. There are two important dates in the bill, the July 1st effective date and the November 1st date by which ADW providers must enter into agreements with our tracks, which meet requirements described in the bill, including a requirement to gain approval of both the horse persons groups and the MRC. If they fail to do so, they will be operating illegally and will be subject to the enforcement provisions outlined in Subdivision 8. As with any statute, the bill describes the broad framework of the law and requires the agency, or in this case, the Minnesota Racing Commission, to implement rules to effectuate the legislative intent of the bill. Most, if not all, states that provide ADW have promulgated rules, and that's approximately 34 states. The Association of Racing Commissioners International, a trade organization comprised of regulators from the 38 parimutuel states in which Minnesota is an active member, has model rules that cover all aspects of horse racing and parimutuel wagering, including ADW. It is MRC's intent to implement rules consistent with the national model rules in this legislation in order to provide, to the extent possible, uniform regulation of these companies which operate across multiple racing jurisdictions. We believe the exempt rulemaking provisions in 14.386, which is being amended, are appropriate in this situation. MRC's normal rulemaking process has taken between 12 and 18 months, although we're making efforts to accelerate that process. We could not have rules in place within the time period set out in the bill absent exempt rulemaking, which still requires substantive review and approval of the Revisor's Office and the Office of Administrative Hearings. Subdivision 9 does one more thing. It removes the two-year sunset provision for the rules that MRC adopts. Again, this was suggested to us by Senate counsel and adopted by amendment in prior committees. It makes sense that once the MRC promulgates rules governing ADW, there is no need to revisit this process, or at least be required to do so within a short time frame. Finally, it bears mention that this bill has the complete support of the entire Minnesota horse racing industry, from horse people to breeders to the associations and racetracks, and has passed through every House and Senate committee thus far with unanimous support. We hope it will do the same today as well. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have on Subdivision 9 or any other aspect of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Chair Hoppe, I don't know if you want to go through amendments now.
Mr. Chair, whichever order you prefer, I kind of explained both of them a little bit. We can certainly explain them in more detail and answer any questions about them. Whichever order sure. You think is proper.
Sure. Are there any member questions or discussion before we... Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is a question for Mr. Shepherd. If you could just briefly explain what the difference between what is currently exempt procedures and the expedited process.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, as the witness has indicated, under the exempt rulemaking process, the revisor of statutes would approve the form of the rules. The commission would vote to adopt them, or they would sign the order adopting the rules. The Office of Administrative Hearings would approve the legality of the rules, and then they would be published in the state register. That's the exempt process. under the expedited process in 14.389, the agency would publish notice of the rule in the State Register and mail it to people on the list of people who requested notice of the agency rules. The agency would then have to allow 30 days after publication in the State Register for comment. The agency would then submit it to the Office of Administrative Hearings for legal review. They'd have 14 days, and then it would be published and would take effect.
Thank you, Mr.
Shepherd. Chair Hoppe, I don't know if you want to, I guess I'll just say I'll take ownership of the A2 amendment, me personally, as
thank you, Mr. Chair.
The chair of the committee as well. I'm not comfortable with exempting an agency from rulemaking in extreme dire circumstances. I think expedited rulemaking is very appropriate for this bill and for this process. With that, members, I'm happy to have any discussion to the A2 amendment. Seeing none, all in favor of the A2, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The A2 is adopted. And then, Chair Hoppe, I'm happy to move the A16 as well. Now, is this more of an author's amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair, and thank you for moving the amendment. This is the one I spoke of earlier. It's a product of people from the Racing Commission, from Canterbury, from Running Aces, getting together with the folks from Churchill Downs. Nobody's an enemy here. Everybody's wants the same thing. We're just trying to figure out to get it. And I'd like to thank everybody that worked on this and coming up with maybe not 100% peace in the valley, but a nice, pretty nice start on the compromise.
Excellent. With that, any discussion, members, before we put the bill in the shape the author wishes? Seeing none, all in favor of the A16, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. With that, Mr. Chair, I guess two-year bill is amended. Do you have any other comments for the committee?
Mr. Chair, members, we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, is there any final member questions or discussions to House File 3211? Seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 3211 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means as amended. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, members.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next bill on the agenda, we have House File 3213, Representative Kahn. Representative Kahn, I think we passed one of your bills, our very first committee of the biennium, one of your minute bills. We just figured we'd kind of end things with one of your bills as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's so nice to be the bookends of such a wonderful committee, which I actually chaired once. And I did one thing which every one of you people should thank me for. The best thing I ever did in the legislature was before I chaired government operations, the pension bill used to be just every separate bill went by itself, and I was the one who insisted on an omnibus pension bill.
Well, we do thank you for that. That's legitimate.
Yes.
With that, Representative Kahn, I'll move House File 3213 to the Committee on State Government Finance to your bill.
Okay. Well, our world is increasingly interconnected in almost every way. For several years, I've been involved with the work of World Without Genocide, a human rights organization located at the Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul. One of the hallmarks of the organization is the connection that gets made between global issues and their impact on communities here in Minnesota. The bill we're discussing today is about conflict minerals in Congo. We'll have testimony from three people about the situation in Congo and the way it involves every one of us here, and an opportunity for state purchasing of electronics to have a positive effect. First, I'll introduce Dr. Ellen Kennedy, who is the Executive Director of World Without Genocide and an adjunct law professor at Mitchell Hamline, to explain the bill and its contents.
Chair Sanders, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to talk about HF 3213. You've all heard of diamonds that were used in the 1980s to finance brutal conflict in parts of Africa. They were called blood diamonds. Today, a similar tragedy is occurring with minerals that are in all of our small electronics, our phones, laptops, computer games, music players, and more. Every time your cell phone vibrates, it's because of a mineral called coltan. 80% of the world's coltan comes from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Since 1996, more than 6 million people have been killed in Congo because of coltan and other valuable minerals. Brutal militia groups are fighting over these nearly priceless resources that have become labeled conflict minerals. Innocent people, especially women and girls, are the victims as these militias attempt to gain control of the land and the riches. My phone and my laptop and yours have coltan, tin, tungsten, and other minerals taken from under the ground in Congo. In 2010, the U.S. government passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. Part of this bill requires publicly traded U.S. electronics companies like Apple, Intel, and Motorola to report to the Securities and Exchange Commission annually where they buy these resources that are used in their products. If any of the conflict minerals originated in Congo or one of its neighboring countries, the company must describe its due diligence taken to determine the source of the minerals. Dodd-Frank does not require the companies to divest from Congo or to source their minerals only from conflict-free mines. The law only requires something very simple, that companies report on their mineral sourcing and their due diligence practices. The idea is very simple. Having a transparent supply chain will incentivize the manufacturers to choose their materials from mines that use good practices. Here in Minnesota, the city of Edina adopted a resolution several years ago requiring that city electronics purchases be made only from companies that are compliant with Dodd-Frank. Last year, the Minnesota State Bar Association did the same. Two states, California and Maryland, have passed legislation requiring that state electronics come only from companies that comply with Dodd-Frank. A recent analysis has shown that this simple process of transparency has improved the situation in Congo significantly. We have a precedent for asking the Minnesota legislature to become involved with this local to global connection. In 2008, the Minnesota legislature and Governor Pawlenty passed a bill to divest our state public pension fund from companies at the time that were complicit with the genocide in Darfur. The global is the local. Minnesotans did not want their tax dollars here used to support a genocide on the other side of the world. Today, I ask you to take a similar step. We have delivered more than 1,000 constituent letters to House members in the past few weeks, and we have more of them today for some of you who have not yet received yours. Support transparent purchasing of electronics by our state government here. This is not a bill that has to do with partisanship. This is a bill that has to do with our ethics, with our morality, and with our sense of commitment to one another. It requires no money. It assures that going forward, Minnesotans do the right thing. Each of us is responsible because of the phones in our pockets, and each of us can make a difference in the lives of people far away. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I think everyone should speak and then be available for questions. Is that?
Yep, that's fine. Okay. Representative Kahn, if we could, okay. Those that are wishing to testify, yes. If you could please make your way towards the testimony table. We ask that you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes. The next person is Dr. Edwige
Mubanzi is a physician from the Democratic Republic of Congo. She worked in Northeast Congo, where there is a battle for control over the region's valuable minerals. Rape is being used as a tool of war in this conflict. Dr. Mubanzi performs reparative surgery for women whose bodies have been traumatized by rape. Her patients range in age from 3 months to 76 years. Rapes in Congo occur at such an alarming rate that Congo is called the rape capital of the world. After threats on her life, Dr. Mubanzi fled from Congo, and she now lives in St. Paul, where she advocates for laws and policies to prevent these atrocities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. I am very thankful for this opportunity to share my story with you. My name is Edwige Mubanzi. I am a medical doctor from the Democratic Republic of Congo. In my country, I worked in a mobile clinic, which means I went to rural areas to find and treat women victims of sexual abuse and mutilation as part of the ongoing conflict in my country. Rape is used as a weapon of war in Congo. The war is about controlling our mineral resources, especially coltan, which is used for cell phones and computers all over the world. 80% of the world's supply of coltan comes from the eastern part of Congo, where I am from. Since 1998, more than 400,000 women and girls have been raped in this war. Today, my country is called the rape capital of the world. Rape is an effective war strategy, and it's destroying my community. Usually, women are raped in front of their husbands and children. This destroys the world family and enables militias to control population and therefore the mineral resources. After raping a woman, soldiers and militias members often insert an object such as wood, knives, guns, or fire into the vagina of women. This practice destroys a woman's body, often causing a leakage of bodily fluid from the vagina and the inability to have children, and it completely destroys her spirit. Mr. Chair and member of the committee, I would like to share a little story of one of my patients with you. One day during my night shift at Panzi Hospital, it was 2 a.m., I received a woman that I knew because I had treated her before. I was afraid that she was a victim because she was raped and she got pregnant from that rape. She was carrying a little baby of 6 months. Then she told me that she didn't come to see me because of her baby. She came to see me because of her baby. This is a 6-month-old baby, born of rape, who was raped also. This baby had the liquid coming from her stomach through her vagina, and all the physical findings were horrible. This has become an intergenerational problem. This is the only reason why I decided, besides treating my patient, to start to do advocacy work for them. And this is the only reason why I'm here today. We all know the close connection between the exploitation and illegal trade of natural resources and how these finances armed group and massive human rights violations. We cannot continue to only repair the consequences of the violence. We must treat the root cause of this violence to put an end to these horrific crimes. Minerals from Congo need to be mined in a lawful manner that respects the lives of all people. This is why I'm here, engaged in a plea for peace, justice, and respect for human rights. It's urgent to take to act. The solution exists and requires real political will. Mr. Chair and member of the committee, the vote in support of this bill will be a victory for human rights and stability in my country, the Democratic Republic of Congo. With humility and hope, I now urge this committee to support this legislation to help transform blood minerals into minerals for development and peace. This is an opportunity to solve the real problem of Congo, and we need your support. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Doctor, for your testimony.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, the final speaker is Rachel Carlson, a third-year student at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Rachel is a Benjamin B. Ferenc Fellow in Human Rights and Law, a program run by World Without Genocide, and she has worked on this conflict minerals issue for the past 3 years.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairman Sanders, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. Dr. Kennedy mentioned that improvements have been made in Congo since the implementation of Dodd-Frank at the federal level. I'd like to share some of those advancements. Congolese officials, the United Nations, and the International Conference on the Great Lakes region have developed a conflict-free certification process that has led to 166 mines being designated as conflict-free. This certification is similar to the Kimberley process that was used to certify diamonds 30 years ago. Minerals sold from mines without this certification are appraised at a dollar value that is 30 to 60% less than minerals originating from certified mines. This directly affects the profits of the armed militia groups responsible for the horrific violence throughout the eastern region of Congo. Steps have been taken at the smelting and refining levels of the supply chain to ensure that minerals leaving the affected region are conflict-free. Close to 70% of these operations have improved significantly through auditing measures. These positive changes exist solely as a result of the transparency reporting measures of Dodd-Frank. Yet, there is so much that still must be done. During 2012, the first year of Dodd-Frank reporting, over 1,300 companies worked towards supply chain transparency. This number keeps increasing. An estimated 1,000 of the companies that reported in 2014 have gone beyond the required SEC reports and have voluntarily submitted conflict minerals analysis documents. Almost half of them created plans to become entirely conflict-free, a sign that the company's managements want to ensure that making their products does not support the devastations in Congo. Companies that are complying with this reporting are easily found on the SEC's database, where their reports are made available for up to 4 years after filing. State bills limiting contract procurement only to companies that are abiding by Dodd-Frank increases the industry's overall commitment to transparency. This bill increases Minnesota's dedication to transparency in government spending. This is good fiscal policy, and it's also good ethics. I've worked on this issue for my entire 3 years of law school. Like most people of my generation, my phone and my computer play an increasingly large role in my daily life. I know that unless the situation continues to improve, women and girls in Congo will suffer. Also, that women my age in safe locations like Minnesota can make phone calls or check their emails, all without ever thinking of the consequences. But I think about those consequences. Today, I urge you to think about those consequences too. Please do not mistake this matter as being someone else's problem or an issue removed from us entirely by geography. This is an issue that literally sits on all of our desks. It is in every single one of our pockets or purses. By simply adjusting our approach to purchases right here from Minnesota, we can make a difference in Congo. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's the end of our testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent. Representative Nelson.
She did not introduce herself, so maybe we should do that for the tape.
She did well. Go ahead for the record.
Okay,
you can reintroduce yourself.
I apologize. Rachel Carlson.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Members, any questions, any discussion? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Carlson, could you just repeat the database that is searchable for the companies that have signed on?
Sure. If you go to the Securities and Exchange
SEC. Okay.
Sorry, if you go to the SEC's database, you can go to the EDGAR search function, E-D-G-A-R search function, and reports from Dodd-Frank are available for up to 4 years after filing, so you can see all the companies that are compliant.
All right, thank you.
Members, any other questions or discussion? I will ask Representative Kahn, I know in Subdivision 2 we have the prohibition listed. Do we have an issue right now or a problem in Minnesota with the commissioners maybe being outside of this currently, or where are we at currently in the state of Minnesota?
I don't think, well, let me turn to someone who knows the answer.
Sure, Ms. Carlson?
I can speak to that. Approximately 95% of the contracts procured in Minnesota are currently compliant, so it's only a small fraction that need to step up to the reporting requirement.
The point that, Mr. Chairman, the point that I had made is that this bill is not really carving new grounds. It's just emphasizing a federal law that already exists and making sure that we're in compliance with it.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Any further member questions or discussion? Seeing none, do you have any final comments on the bill?
I don't. I appreciate the attention that the committee members paid, and I appreciate having the hearing at this time.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3213 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Kahn.
Thank you.
Members, we have completed the agenda. I want to take a moment and have a big thank you for our CA, Amanda Tinsley, and our CLA, Nolan West. This committee would not have functioned without them, trust me. A huge thank you again to our House research, Mr. Shepard, Ms. Dyson, Mr. Gehring, experts, and always trusted and respected. And we appreciate your time and your impact and influence in this committee. I want to thank Representative Nelson, the lead on this committee as well. Members, I think we had a great committee this year. Not too many committees get to deal with the breadth of issues and the different subject areas that we get to deal with, which is exciting and frustrating and time-consuming, but nonetheless extremely important. And I want to thank as well Partisan Research, Ms. Loesch, and Mr. Geldman as well for all of their work in the committee. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe I too express my thanks to our staff. We never give them enough credit for the hard work that they do and making us all look as good as they make us look. The question I have for you, Mr. Chair, we're going to be meeting again probably to take a pension bill. Might there be other bills that get sent our way that have to get sent to rules because we're past deadlines, but I know the pension bill should be coming up.
Correct, Representative Nelson. We will have the pension bill, which I know Representative O'Driscoll is currently building with the Pension Commission. We also have, I believe, at least one hearing on a campaign finance board selection, and then any other bills that will get a rules waiver that need to move along in the process, we'll also hear those. Again, we'll give everyone as much notice as possible when we hear those. I don't have any time reference right now as to when any of those will be as of now, but when we do, we will certainly let everyone know. But with that, members, staff, thank you so much for all the work that we're able to do. Appreciate it very much. Hope everyone has a good weekend. With that, we are adjourned.